The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 172, a panel entitled 20-Year Reflections on the Mark Hoffman Bombings, with Steve Mayfield, Kurt Bench, Doralee Olds, Gretchen Sheets-McNeese, and Newell Bringhurst, and Brent Lee Metcalf. I got an end.
All right, good afternoon, folks. This is session 172. I'm sorry? I just have to speak loud. That's hard for me to do. Thank you, Newell. This is session 172, entitled 20 Years Reflections on the Mark Hoffman Bombings / Murders. It's been 20 years since that fateful October day in Salt Lake where bombs went off in two locations, killing businessman and bishop Steve Christensen, and then another part of the valley killing Kathleen Sheets. This is a tragedy that not only affected these families of these two pit victims, but shook the community, both of the state and of the church. For the next day, a bomb went off, this time injuring document dealer Mark Hoffman. Very quickly, this became more than just a newsworthy item of a murder, but involvement of the church and even into police work and forensics, a matter that has become one of the more celebrated cases, controversial matters in LDS history, probably up there with polygamy, blacks in the priesthood, Mount Meadows Massacre, and women's issues in the church. In those 20 years, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of some books being written on the subject. If those who have received a handout, this is not an inclusive list of either the tapes of Sunstone or the listing of books. It's just what I could throw together, so don't think it's all inclusive. But it's a matter that has constantly been on the minds and thoughts of people. In fact, this morning, one of the local talk shows, an individual talk show host was talking about the Unabomber case and then mentioned the Salt Lake bomber, Mark Hoffman. So it's still very much in our psyche. But instead of rehearsing that case and going over the who, what, where, and how, and why, we're going to try to do something different today. We have brought a very interesting group of people, some of which had very close relationships with Mark Hoffman, and they're going to discuss what they have, their reflections on the matter after 20 years, and the most important thing, what have we learned from the case? Our speakers today are first Kurt Bench, who at the time was manager of the old books section of the Deseret Book, has since started his own business of Benchmark Books, who has gathered over the years material on Hoffman, has talked to many people, and has continued an interest in the matter. Then there is Doralee Olds. This is a start for Doralee. Doralee, for those who are not aware, is Mark Hoffman's ex-wife. And this, other than maybe a few moments a few years ago at a symposium called Genuine Fakes, sponsored by Ken Sanders Books, I think this is probably the first time you've had a chance to speak. So we're looking forward to that. She is a business owner, a life coach for... That's Academy of Life Management, right?
Yes.
And also a hypnotist. And she may be able to explain some of that for us. We also have Gretchen Sheets-McNeese down at the far end. Gretchen is the daughter of Catherine Sheets and Gary Sheets. And because of the influence or the impact of this matter on her life, she is presently working as a detective for the Salt Lake City Police Department. She's married to a West Valley police officer, and she is the mother of two youngins, both boys. So then we have Newell Bringhurst, probably the one outsider of the group. He's an instructor of history at the College of Sequoia in Visalia, California, and was kind enough to, when I asked him to speak from the viewpoint of a historian and the impact of Mark Hoffman on the historian. And our last speaker will be Brent Lee Metcalf, who's a, boy, I forgot your title. You're a Technical editor, that's correct. In living up in the Seattle area, Brent was an associate and a researcher that assisted Mark in a lot of his cases. We don't want to take too much further ado, so if there's any more information that these folks want to provide to you, they'll do it when they get up here. So, Kirk, you're first.
Well, I was supposed to give this paper 5 years ago, except then it was 15 years reflection. But I decided that it would be much more fun to go to the hospital for 12 days. And I had an aortic aneurysm that sort of imposed itself on me and made it impossible for me to show up here. So I did think about it back then, and I've thought about it since. And I'm glad, actually, to be able to give it now, 20 years later, because it was very close to not being able to give it at all. So it's amazing how, I mean, everyone here has an awareness of what happened 20 years ago. I mean, you all have your own experiences of what you remember. I'm sure some of the younger ones maybe don't remember much. And it's funny, as I run into that, some years ago I was asked to speak to a group of students at Ricks College about the Mark Hoffman experience. And as I just launched into it, I saw all these puzzled looks, and I said, "Now, how many of you here know anything about Mark Hoffman?" And about the only ones who raised their hands were the faculty members who were there, and the students were too young. And now, of course, it's even more that way now that it's been 20 years. Hard to believe it's been two decades since those events occurred that had a shattering effect on a lot of people. And everyone has their own experience from that. And there were a lot of people who were affected. And the one thing, when asked, well, what were the effects of this whole affair? Usually people are asking me or asking others how it affected the market, you know, the documents market, rare books or whatever. Or sometimes they mean, how did it affect the church? The thing that we can't ever forget is that the biggest effect that it had was on those who lost loved ones. Mark Hoffman took the lives of two wonderful, innocent people. And we can't ever forget that when we talk about the marketplace, rare books, rare documents, what they sell for, and some of the lighter moments from the olden days when we used to do business. I have lots of personal memories of Mark, and many of them were lighter moments. But sometimes when you get talking about the business aspect or Mormon history, you forget that despite the forgeries that we tend to focus on, that murder was done. And we must never, ever forget that. A lot of people ask me, what effect has it had on the marketplace? What's changed since then? I want to go into that just a little bit. Do we do things differently today? I'm going to refer to BH and AH, before Hoffman and after Hoffman, because I tend to think in those terms when it comes to this subject, because he did have an enormous impact on the trade and on lives. Personally, as far as its effect on me, one of the things that, and not just me, but one of the victims in this case was trust. And I feared that after Mark, who had been, I felt, a good friend, and many of you know and some of you do not, that at the same time, my assistant at Deseret Book, an employee, was was in the process of committing grand larceny and did so for 3 years and actually stole $250,000 from us. And he was an even closer friend. And so after all this, I wondered if I would ever trust anyone again. And I kidded with people that shortly thereafter I was hiring a private investigator to look into my father's background and family members and friends. I feared that I would not trust or that I would continue to suffer from a degree of paranoia and suspicion and perhaps even cynicism. And I did go through a little bit of a paranoid era there, I guess, but I don't think I ever became cynical, but that's not to say that I was never cynical, because unfortunately there are too many in high and low places whose behavior makes us question motive and behavior and But I don't think that I ever lost the trust that I feared I would lose in other individuals, because in my business, dealing with people every day, especially on matters of great trust, there has to be that bond, even with people that you don't know. And I didn't want to lose that, and fortunately I did not lose that. Speaking of that subject, one of the things that has been cited so many times as a fallout from this whole thing was people were very disillusioned, perhaps. There were a number of people who were disillusioned and even became disaffected, because when it was discovered that Mark Hoffman had forged a number of documents and had presented some of those documents to leaders of our church, and including the First Presidency, the Anthem transcript, for example. We have photographs of him meeting with the First Presidency and others. And people later on were very disturbed by that. Why didn't they have the spirit of discernment? Why didn't they know that he was a phony? Why didn't they know that he was a forger or the type of person he really was? Maybe I'm just pretty simple-minded, and I know a lot of you will agree that that's true. But I thought, I'm really sympathetic to them, because I was one of many people who were totally and completely taken in by Mark and fooled. His wife, ex-wife, is sitting here with us. His parents. Sorry, I didn't mean to slip there. Unless there's something we don't know. No. His parents, his loved ones, his friends, his ward members, people all around him, everybody that I know of was fooled by Mark. So why not fool the brethren? Dallin Oaks later said that we approached him, and as we approach everyone, with on the basis of trust, unless someone does something to prove that they're not trustworthy. So I just think I'm in really good company. And I got fooled along with everybody else. So that really wasn't a faith-destroying element for me, as it was for some. And I think it's really sad. And that's one of the big effects that had. There were people, there weren't just lives taken, there was faith taken. There were, I don't know if you want to put it simplistically, maybe testimonies taken. In that manner, and I find that very sad. So what has happened in the marketplace? Do we do things differently today? What's the market like? A lot of people ask me this. One thing I wanted to mention, Brent said something to remind me. Another one of the amusing things that often comes out of this is when people see our name, Benchmark Books. First of all, they think my name is Mark, and as my employees will tell you, there are a number of people, even that have known me for years, that address letters to Mark, that call me Mark. They just, I don't know, but some have said, with a little sly little grin, they say, "Oh, is that from Mark Hoffman?" Yes, I thought so much of him, and he had such a wonderful impact on my life that I named my business after him. Another amusing thing is people often ask me, well, how's Mark doing? You know, what's he doing out there? You know, is he still out at the Point of the Mount? I say, well, you know, I really like to go visit him all the time and have nice long chats. And, of course, we exchange gifts at Christmas. I mean, what are you thinking? No, I have no idea. So please don't ask me how he's doing. They also asked me about my former employee. You know, well, what's he doing lately? Of course, he ended up teaching early morning seminary and was a young men's president and so on, even though he had stolen $250,000 from a church-owned company. But that's another story altogether. talk about something that can destroy a testimony. Anyway, today's I've tried to think of, well, what's happening in the national marketplace? What do dealers do that deal in rare documents? And do we, in the trade, do we now, because of all these valuable lessons that we've learned, don't we test every document that we touch? And don't we, you know, check it out thoroughly? Well, frankly, no. Generally, we don't, because first of all, testing is very, very expensive to do physical testing of documents. And another thing is, we found out that experts can be fooled, because Mark was very good, and so generally documents aren't tested. What happened to the market? What happened to prices? The Mormon document market shortly after the Hoffman affair, and then for quite a long time, was, as you might imagine, was seriously depressed. There never was a huge market with lots and lots of collectors. It's always been a rather limited thing, but it really took a nosedive. And there has been somewhat of a comeback in Mormon money, just in case you're interested, early Mormon money, which also had seriously gone down in value, and very little interest is quite, I hate to use this term, but it is quite hot now. Some people probably wonder if it is hot when they see it, but it's that's really rebounded quite well. Rare books were never really affected that much unless they were signed, and that still can be an issue. Do national dealers do anything differently? I haven't observed any drastic changes. All of autograph dealers and rare documents dealers and book dealers that are worth their salt certainly know about what happened. But I haven't seen any big changes in how they do business. I think everyone's a little bit more wary. I've become much more wary and sometimes even suspicious, but we tend to focus a lot on a term that I'm sure you probably heard, and that is provenance. Whereas before, we didn't really pay as much attention to that as we should. In other words, it's the genealogy or the background of a given item. It might be a piece of art or a document. Who owned it? Where did it come from? Can you trace it back to its beginnings or as far back as possible? Ironically, most of the provenance we received early on from Mark was made up by Mark. So there were some great stories about how he found certain documents in family, prominent church family lines and so on. He even hired one of my employees who is a genealogist to research family lines, and he only quit when Mark started bouncing his paychecks. But we thought that he was giving us the true story on where things came from. But we're much more oriented that way now. We want to find out who owned it, and if it's been in a family for many, many years, then we tend to trust it much more. We try to deal with people that we can trust whenever we know that. And so that's the single thing that we can do the most today, and that's probably changed the most, is we want to find out where these things came from as best we can. Sales are better than they were, but there will be a permanent impact on the document business, I think, because of Mark. But still, because Mormons especially want to own a piece of their history, there will always be some demand for signed documents, certain books and things like that. And so that's something that I think will continue on. I'm sure I'm at the end of my time. Have we learned our lessons? Could this ever happen again? It could happen again. I think it's doubtful, and it would take someone with the same kind of skill as Mark had, and he had great skills. But I think it would be more difficult for it to happen today. But any time you have a lot of money to be made on anything, there's always the potential that there will be dishonesty and deception. I think we've learned some valuable lessons. I think we have learned what someone who is determined to do something, even if it's destructive, can accomplish that if he wants to bad enough. And we have to be sensitive enough to, I wish I could say we could look into the hearts of all of those whom we deal with on a personal basis or business basis, but we can't. But we still have to do it on the basis of trust. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you about this. I think that everyone here can probably give their own version of what effect the Mark Hoffman affair has had on their life. And if we had time, maybe we could do that. But thank you.
When Steve asked me to do this presentation, I was very calm and collected, and I knew that there would be a price to pay. I knew there would be a price to pay, because whenever I speak, I always get tons of emotion, and I'm definitely in emotion today. So just know that that's happening. I've only had 15 minutes, so I'm not going to be able to tell you about the being in the hospital after the car bomb and watching on TV all of your personal possessions being hauled out through the house and all the neighbors and TV watching. So, and I'm not going to be able to tell you about what it's like to know that the house has just been deeded away from you by your husband to his family and not having a penny, wondering what's going to happen to you in your life. And I'm not going to be able to tell you about how both sides of my family have been very supportive of Mark, and I have felt in a lot of ways abandoned as they have supported him and as he is in his poor state of being in this condition of a criminal. And so I'm not going to have time for those things. But I do want to say to those that are interested here today that I am going to finally come out of the closet, and I'm going to write a book. And so it's going to be beginning. And those that are interested in getting updates or getting sample content before it's published, if you raise your hand, we have cards going around, put your name and email on there, and I will email to you the sample content if you care to have that before it goes to the publisher. What I can talk about is about waking up. And as I look at my life with this, the history of my life with Mark and the history of the healing I've had after everything has been over and left to pick up the pieces, what I can say is that this story is about waking up. And as I came into this marriage, as I got married to this wonderful man, I had all the list, all the things that I needed to have on the list about what was needed to be a husband. And obviously it was present in form, but not actually. And when Steve asked me the question, how can we prevent this from happening again? As Kurt mentioned, although there's always going to be schemers, there's always going to be people who see a way to make a buck, and they're going to try. And the only way that we can prevent that is from being awake and aware and taking care of ourselves. We can't control when or where those things are going to happen. We can't control who is going to be presenting us with an offer that sounds too good to be true. What we can do is take care of our response and see where we have attachments, where we have investments. And as I look at the things that Mark did, what he did was he played off different groups of people. He created things that people could not say no to. He created items that the emotion was so strong, the meaning was so strong, that it was really hard to say no. And it was very hard to say, I'm not interested. And he created either through the fear of, we better keep this under wraps and not let everyone have it, or through, oh, this is so important that I want to be the first one, I want to be the one to own it. As Kurt mentioned, people like to have those documents in their possession. And so the best way to prevent this is for each of us to see, where is it that I get drug around? Where is it that I get emotional, that I get drug around, that I find myself losing my senses in a way and get drug around? And one of the things I noticed for myself with this situation, with this marriage, is that there are a lot of places, looking back, as I look back now from this place of where I'm in a more healed place, looking back, and there were a lot of places where there were things were amiss, things were not quite right. I would ask into it, he would have a ready answer, very easily say why things were going on, and I was either unable to see or I was unwilling because I didn't want to rock the boat. And not able to see what was going on. And I had a question that posed to me the other day and said, when did you first know? And I answered the question and said, I think at this time. But as I've been with that, when the first document came out, Mark came in the house, he had this book, and he said, come and sit down right now and look at this book. Well, he's never done that before. And I said, no, I'll just look at it later, I'm busy. No, you need to come down right now. And he sat by my side and helped me flip open the pages, and there, lo and behold, was this document. That's never happened before, and it's never happened since. I wonder if that may have been a red flag about why is it that it was so important to sit me down. So I think part of me was wondering what this was about and why he was behaving that way. So there's many areas where I can say there were things going on, but to say I ever knew the plan, the agenda, that all this was going on, in some ways I say I still don't know. I'm still learning from other people as they tell me their stories what actually was going on. And part of that, I have felt bad. I've wondered if I had been able to see what was going on, if I could have prevented some of the things that were happening and maybe stopped them. But as I have had further reflection, I needed to be asleep. I needed to be asleep until it was safe enough for me to wake up. Because if I'd woken up too soon, I probably would have ended up like Lori Hacking, because I would have been a danger. And that's exactly what happened with Steve, I believe, is he became a danger. He was someone that needed to be eliminated. And I would have been another victim in that way. And I needed to be around for my family. I needed to be around for my children. And so I'm very grateful that I was asleep, and that as I got into a safe place after he was gone, that I was able to begin to have a healing and begin to see more and more areas where I have given myself away and created this environment for myself in a way. I participated with it in the way that I was unconscious. And I now get to participate through my experience. I get to participate in helping others who are in stress situations, wondering why they're stressed, what's going on in their life. I get to help them participate in helping them to wake up and helping them to have a better life and seeing where those places where they give themselves away. And my challenge to you is to see where you get drug around. I look at the different opposite groups. There's one group that are loudly proclaiming against the church, against Joseph Smith, against all of these things. And I say to them that there may be a subconscious part of them is afraid, with all their loud protesting, that that the church may be true. They're just really loudly protesting that. Then the other group, that is what I call the church apologists, who are out cleaning all the history up, making it look squeaky clean. Every leader is practically perfect in every way, never a mistake, or only certain mistakes that they're allowed to have, and they have to erase everything else. And I think maybe there's a part of them that in that subconscious part that's afraid maybe it isn't true. And I don't believe that either one is correct. I think that our leaders are people. They had their learning process like anyone else, and there are a lot of interesting facts in history. And I think that our fear of the history, the members of the church have a fear of our history, and I think that creates a lot of ways, an environment where Mark could do the things he did. And my challenge is to be able to let go of that fear and be able to read the stories and know that these people were men and that they were called of God, but they were still men. And I wonder sometimes if Moses was under as much scrutiny as Joseph Smith, how his life would have, the history would have been for him if he was scrutinized as much. But my intention from this point on is to continue to wake up, continue to be conscious, continue to see where I, in my relationships, get drug around and get where I'm not thinking clearly. And my challenge to you is to do the same, is to see where it is that you find yourself getting so excited that you're maybe losing reason, or so excited that you can't stop from doing some action or one another. And I do know a good hypnotist that could help you if you need some help. Happy to schedule that for you. It's really a wonderful journey, the waking up. I have lived my life a long time, and I'm finally, as I'm waking up, feeling truly alive, and I'm finally having more joy in my life, having my joy with my children, and it is a joy to be alive. And I'm grateful for that, for those that have helped me. I have great friends that are here today that are of great assistance to me every day. I'm grateful for them. I have a great family. My children are doing well. I have my oldest son is went on a mission and then graduated from the UN Math. He's very like his father, very academically. I want to say challenged. That isn't the right word. Gifted. Academically gifted. And he got married in the temple and is living in California. He finished at the U early, and he's now at UCLA in graduate school. I have two daughters that are going to at the U, and they're doing very well. And then I have my youngest daughter who just graduated from high school, who was going to Westminster in nursing. And they are all doing very well, moving forward on their own journey of healing. I also get asked, how's Mark doing? I have no idea. He stopped talking to me when I divorced him because what he told me was, I know I told you to do it, but I didn't think you would. So he was really mad when I filed. And then a couple of years ago when he wrote a letter, I don't know if you read it in the paper, but he wrote a letter to his youngest daughter talking about this coin that was going up for auction. And as he wrote her and told her that he had been participating in that, I took that letter, took it over to Ken Sanders because it was at the symposium, and it got published, and it ended up shutting down the auction, which I was very thrilled with. This time I could do something. I was very happy that I could do something at this point. But he was really, really mad at me, so now he dictates letters to his mother, and then she writes the letters to me. So I really don't know what he's doing. But my kids go out and see him, and so he has that association with them. But I look forward to the rest of my life. I think that this is, I'm very excited about the journey that I'm taking. And I think that this symposium is a very good place for us, for those that have had this experience, to get some healing and to share stories, because that is where you have the healing, is when you express out what has been your experience. And as you express that out, there is healing. So I'm grateful for these opportunities to talk about these experiences. I do want to leave you with my testimony. I've had many people ask me, well, are you an active member? I am an active member. I have always been. I intend to always be. This journey has only strengthened my testimony. And I know that there are some that have lost their faith through this process. And if I could, I hope that I can help in some way for those to say there is no need, that this is, despite all that has happened, the truth is still there. And I say these things.
My name is Gretchen Binknees, and I am the daughter of Kathleen Webb Sheets and Gary Sheets. For me, I appreciate what Kurt Bench said. You know, I think so many times you lose sight that two people were brutally murdered, and in an ugly way. You know, my mother had just celebrated her 50th birthday party with her friends, and they had provided mush for her and wigs and wrinkly pantyhose, and she was dearly loved in our neighborhood. I didn't want to do this, but You know, we suffered a great loss of a wonderful woman. And she was, I could sit and tell you a lot of stories about her, but as I'm sitting here and listening to people, I'm thinking, you know, this whole experience was very painful for our family and for Steve Christensen's family. It was horrible. I was in college at the time. I was 19. I was in class, and I had a plainclothes police officer come and get me out of class. And he told me, there's been an accident at your home. You need to come with me. And I remember thinking deep down, please let it be a ticket or something that I haven't paid. But I knew that something had happened. I just didn't know what. And we got to the police station in Holiday, and my dad walked out, and he told me in front of the police station what had happened. And it was like somebody just ripped out all the bones of my body, and I just crumpled to the ground. A neighbor friend of ours had gone to the area where my mother was murdered, and there was a lot of blood. And I know this. We have a new thing now with victims. When there are homicide scenes, that they will clean up for the victims before the victims have to go back into their homes. And it was established in 1987. We also have crime victims reparation that is available for victims. And we didn't have that at the time. And so our neighbor, Mike Bridge, went over there after my mother's body had been removed and cleaned up all the blood and scrubbed with a pail and a bucket and a scrubbing brush. So we wouldn't have to see that when we went back to our house. You know, those are the types of things that you deal with when you have a situation like this. My mother loved children. She adored them. She had a fully stocked nursery. She had 3 grandkids that she couldn't get enough of. You know, a crib. She had clothes with the tag still on in the nursery. And she only got to experience 3 of those children. You know, I have 2 boys now, and it just kills me that I don't have a mother to share that experience with. When I was pregnant with my first baby, I was at Babies R Us, and I was walking around trying to figure out what to buy for my baby, and I had no idea what to get. I didn't have my mother there. And I saw all these young women with their mothers helping them pick out bottles and helping them pick out little outfits, and I just started crying in the middle of Babies R Us, and I went to my sister's house. I called her on the phone. I said, you need to come home. I told her I was so upset I didn't know what to buy. She met me at home. She says, come with me. And my sister Heidi, she's sitting right over here. But Heidi's meticulous, and she's very organized, and she has everything very organized in her house. And she took me into her garage and pulled out all these baby outfits. They were Feltman Brother outfits that my mother had bought with the tags still on them, and she had saved them all these years, and she says, these are for you, and they're from your mom. And both my babies were blessed in those outfits. I just think we can't forget the impact and the loss that Steve Christensen's family has experienced and our family has experienced by the poor choices that Mark Hoffman made that terrible day of October 15th. It was a very devastating time and confusing time for our family because we weren't really allowed to grieve, because it was such a media circus at that time, and it was so confusing and so difficult. I remember I went to a Halloween party right after this had happened, and somebody came dressed as a white salamander, you know? And so lots of these types of things were happening to our family. And I remember we were very frustrated we had 2 detectives that were spending a lot of time at our house and informing us of what was happening, Ken Farnsworth and Jim Bell. And that kind of interested my idea in becoming involved with law enforcement because I found the case quite fascinating. And they told us what was going on, but we heard all these false reports of things that were happening, and that was very troublesome for our family. I remember my sister said she went to McDonald's, and Mark was there with his family at McDonald's, and we knew what he had done to our mother, and it was very troublesome to us that he had not been arrested yet, because it took quite a while for him to be arrested. For me, my life and our family's life, my dad remarried a wonderful woman. He lives in St. George. They've been married for 18 years, and He's very active in the church, and they're very happy. His wife has just been called as Relief Society president. She's just busy as can be. I have two sisters, Heidi and Katie, and they're both school teachers. And they both have four children, and they live in the Holiday area. We have a brother that's a hospital administrator and currently lives in Chico, California. He also has four children. And we're all doing quite well. We're very, very close. We're all very active in the church. This hasn't shaken our testimony. In fact, I think it's strengthened our testimonies. I'm kind of the oddball out becoming a police officer. I've been one for 10 years now, and I'm currently a detective investigating sex crimes. I've been married for 6 years. I actually met my husband in the jail. He was working at the jail at the time, booking or processing the inmates in, and I was booking in an inmate, and I wish I could remember that inmate's name that I booked in to thank him for introducing me to my husband. You know, there's some interesting points to this, too. When I was still in college, and I was in the sorority up at the university, and I had gotten asked to a sorority function by a man that lived in my neighborhood that was a good friend of mine, and people said, have you been asked to the Beta Formal? And I'm like, yeah, I got asked to the Beta Formal. And they're like, well, who asked you? Well, this particular gentleman, his name was Mark Kaufman. Not the Mark Kaufman, but another Mark Kaufman. And I told people I'm going with Mark Kaufman, and they said, Gretchen, that's not funny. And I said, I really am going to the dance. And it, you know, so that was kind of interesting. I don't think we could really date or have a relationship because of the name. But I would just like to say that, you know, this has impacted my life. 20 years later, I'm up here being a boob, you know, but it is difficult. It's difficult to have somebody you love killed, and it's difficult to have it be such a media frenzy, and it's difficult to understand why somebody would do something like that, that's so cold and calculating, and take somebody that you love so dearly away from you. I guess some of the things that I've learned... I really believe in life after death. I'm so excited for that opportunity to spend time with my mom. I've got to tell her all my good cop stories because I'm sure she would just love them. But I look forward to that reunion that we'll have. It's made me a stronger person. It's made me very close with my family, and it's been really fun to become a mother. I have a almost a three-year-old, and an 11-month-old, and it's been just absolutely fascinating, and I do feel my mother's presence continually on that time with how I interact with my kids. So I guess that's where I'm at right now and where our family's at. We're doing quite well, and we're very grateful for the relationships and the blessings that we've had throughout the years. It's been difficult, but we've grown, and I think through a lot of your trials and tribulations, it makes you a lot stronger. So that's all I have to say. Thanks.
I guess I'm really the outsider here. I sort of feel a little bit like James Stockdale, who was some of you are old enough to remember when he was selected to be Ross Perot's running mate after a number of others had turned him down. What am I doing here? And I'll let you in a little secret. Dora Lee and I have something in common. We both married Hoffmans. My wife's maiden name was Mary Ann Hoffman. I can admit this for the first time, but different spelling. Hers is with two F's and one N. So I guess there, you know, you mentioned dating a Mark Hoffman, but seriously, I'm very pleased and honored to be here, and I hope I have something of significance to say, because in sharp contrast to the other members of this panel, I had no direct interaction with Mark Hoffman or was directly affected by the fallout from his malevolent activities of some 20 years ago. I was not even living in Utah at the time of the 1985 bombings or during the preceding 5 years period when Hoffman was producing his forgeries and passing them off as genuine. My assigned role on this panel, as directed by my good friend Steve Mayfield over here, who coerced me into this assignment, is to offer a historical evaluation on the Mark Hoffman phenomenon, both short and long term. Specifically, how did the 5-year-long Mark Hoffman saga impact on the writing and research of Mormon history? Let me assert from the very beginning that there were both positive and negative effects. One positive effect resulting from all of this, from his forgeries in particular, particularly his White Salamander letter, was that it directed the attention of historians to the folk magic elements in the culture in which early Mormonism emerged. This, the acute observation of BYU professor David L. Paulson, or as stated more vividly by prolific Community of Christ scholar Roger Lanius, the Hoffman documents opened a Pandora's box of concern about the subject. Confronting Mormon folk magic were noted LDS scholars Ron Walker, Dean Jesse, and Marvin Hill, who initially tried to downplay the connection between folk magic and Joseph Smith's role as a religious leader. By contrast, Pulitzer Prize-winning non-Mormon historian Alan Taylor, and especially D. Michael Quinn, in his definitive award-winning Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, asserted a very close, direct connection. Even Richard L. Bushman, whose faithful history approach emphasizing the sacred nature of Mormon history, felt the need to attempt an integration of Smith's folk magic tradition with his later career as a Latter-day Saint prophet. This is reflected in both Bushman's Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, as well as his forthcoming Joseph Smith Rough Stone Rolling, to be published in October 2005 by Alfred A. Knopf. We're all equally awaiting that book, and I've actually had a chance to read the uncorrected page proof, and it's going to be a seminal work, I can promise you that. A second positive effect of the Hoffman forgeries is that it forced historians of Mormon history to examine more carefully the many sources available and see if there were any that might have been overlooked or misinterpreted. This, the acute observation of Leonard J. Arrington, the Dean of Mormon Historians. Arrington further pointed out that, quote, Latter-day Saint history is rich in source material. Going on to note that scholars do not have to depend on one or two or even a dozen documents. A new document is still just one of many evidences out there, and its principal usefulness comes in that it causes us to look again at all of the evidence and consider what we have previously concluded. Now, moving to the negative. On the clearly negative side, Mark Hoffman's activities caused certain LDS church spokesmen and leaders not friendly to Mormon historical inquiry to condemn and demean the larger field of Mormon historical scholarship. Even before Hoffman brought forth his first forgery, the Anthem manuscript, in April 1980, Mormon history was already drawing the wrath of certain influential leaders in the Mormon hierarchy. The so-called Arrington Spring of the LDS Church Historical Department had ended suddenly with the removal of Leonard J. Arrington from his position as LDS Church Historian and the reassignment, i.e. exile, of his staff to the newly created, albeit now defunct, Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History at Brigham Young University. In fact, I've got a theory there that I think in many ways the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute, born in this controversy, was maybe stillborn in many ways and carried the seeds of its own destruction. But that's a subject for another paper. I don't want to go into that here. Maybe that'll be for next year's Sunstone Symposium. Adding insult to injury, the LDS Church canceled its sponsorship of the projected 16-volume sesquicentennial history of the church, then in the process of being prepared under Arrington's general supervision. As Hoffman produced and sold his various forgeries, things went from bad to worse concerning relations between LDS officials and the Mormon historical community. Mark Hoffman's March 1981 sale of the so-called Joseph Smith III blessing, which was actually canonized for a brief period in the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants, the sale of that to the LDS Church created a defensive mood in official LDS circles, sometimes bordering on paranoia. This was reflected in the action by concerned church leaders to a subsequent Hoffman forgery, the January 27, 1865 letter from Thomas Bullock to Brigham Young, a document accusing Brigham Young, the church president, of destroying evidence of the Joseph Smith blessing. After secretly obtaining the Bullock letter from Hoffman, church officials promptly locked the document away, refusing to publicly acknowledge its existence until 1985. For some 4 years, Hoffman cleverly exploited the church's mood of paranoia in dealing with LDS officials in the sale of subsequent documents. Hoffman's behavior was both bold and audacious. As author Robert Lindsay notes in his A Gathering of Saints, Hoffman sought to blackmail the church relative to the infamous Salamander letter. For a promise to obtain the McClellan papers, Hoffman received $185,000 obtained through church general authority Hugh Pinnock. Hoffman told church officials whom he was dealing with that he had located the McClellan papers in Texas, carefully noting that if their publication were allowed by outsiders, their disclosure would be devastating to the church. Deeply involved in the McClellan papers negotiations at that time was President Gordon B. Hinckley. Although Hinckley later denied that he had ever asked Hoffman to prevent the McClellan papers from falling into the hands of the enemy. Reflective of such LDS paranoia was a barrage of attacks made by concerned church general authorities against individuals exploring Mormonism's past. Leading this assault was Apostle Dallin Oaks, himself a scholar and student of early Mormon history, ironically the co-author of the award-winning Carthage Conspiracy. Oates publicly decried Mormon scholars who criticized LDS leadership. He told an assembly of religion instructors at BYU that, quote, young people should be instructed to be suspicious of articles and broadcasts regarding church history. He then added, quote, the fact that something is true is not always a justification for communicating it. By the same token, some things that are true are not edifying or appropriate to communicate. Similarly, President Gordon B. Hinckley attacked those scholars, quote, poking into all the crevices of our history, ferreting out little things of small import, and magnifying them into great issues of public discussion and working the media in an effort to give credibility to their efforts, unquote. Apostle Russell M. Nelson went even further, starkly stating, quote, in some instances, the merciful companion of truth is silence. some truths are best unsaid, unquote. But the most scary of all was Apostle Boyd K. Packer, who issued the ultimate warning, declaring that scholars, in pursuing objective research, were placing their salvation at risk. Specifically, Packer stated, quote, "One who chooses to follow the tenets of his profession, regardless of how they may injure the church or destroy the faith of those not ready for what he called advanced history, is himself," that's interesting, he said himself, is himself in spiritual jeopardy. In spiritual jeopardy. Such stern rhetoric was accompanied by official church actions directed against scholars doing historical research. New tighter restrictions were placed on access to historical documents in the Latter-day Saint Church archives. Individual historians were also singled out. Valene Avery and Linda Newell, co-authors of Mormon Enigma, a meticulously researched but frank 1986 biography of Emma Smith, were both banned from speaking at firesides and other LDS meetings and functions. By the early 1990s, Sunstone itself was adversely affected. When scholars teaching at BYU or employed by the church elsewhere were prohibited from participating in or even attending Sunstone Symposia. Shortly thereafter, ultimate church punishment was meted out to offending scholars with the excommunication of the so-called September 6 in the fall of 1993. All these adverse developments had a chilling effect, particularly on those scholars close to the church in faith and or employment, attempting to research and write on Mormonism's past in an honest and frank manner. This latter development, I feel, represents the most negative legacy of the Mark Hoffman episode insofar as the historical community is concerned. But for myself, an outsider, both geographically and in terms of faith, I do not fear retribution in my efforts to research and write about various aspects of Mormonism's controversial past, which continue to fascinate me. Indeed, the stern warnings issued by general authorities, such as Boyd K. Packer, my favorite, actually encourage me in my efforts to probe various fascinating aspects of Latter-day Saints history, be they good, bad, and or indifferent. Thank you.
This is one of those presentations that you don't really look forward to giving. How do you tell the tale of innocence lost? If I can juxtapose three vignettes for you, keep in mind while I'm talking. I think it will help communicate what I'm talking about here. A number of years ago, James E. Faust gave a talk on keeping the Sabbath day holy. And in that talk, he gave an example of a gentleman who owned a tannery. And the dilemma that the gentleman had was that if he went to church and ignored turning his hides, they would spoil, and he would lose all of them. So he was given the promise that if he would go to church faithfully, the hides wouldn't spoil. And they didn't. Second vignette. Late May, early June of 1829, Joseph Smith is dictating to his scribes the Book of Mormon. And he's gone back to fill in the blank spot that the Book of Lehi left. And he dictates a narrative of Lehi and his family and Patriarch Ishmael and his family fleeing Jerusalem. As they leave and on their journey, Ishmael dies. And he's buried in a place that they say was called Nahum. Now, apologists of the Book of Mormon tell us today that that's an actual place name on the Arabian Peninsula, which basically means that when Joseph Smith had his elbows on his knees with his hat up to his face, staring at that stone, dictating the Book of Mormon to his scribes, that God spoke to him with such clarity and precision that he actually received the place name of a geographical location on the Arabian Peninsula with complete accuracy. Third vignette. A photograph adorns the cover of Rick Turley's book, Victims. And in that photograph, we see Mark Hoffman looking down at the Anthon transcript as Spencer W. Kimball, Boyd K. Packer, Gordon B. Hinckley, Marion G. Romney, and Ann Eldon Tanner all look on at the new prize possession. God can preserve tanned hides. He can reveal actual ancient Hebrew words. But he is utterly incapable of speaking to his prophets at a time when it mattered most. He could have saved two innocent lives and exposed a forgery, yet nothing was said. In my view, if God doesn't speak to us or his prophets about the things that matter most, then why should we care whether or not he speaks to us about the things that matter least? For me, the ultimate victim from those bombings was God. He died that day along with Steve, along with Kathy. And I've seen no reason to resuscitate him ever since. I admire those who have been able to retain faith in the light of such horrific events. To me, it's utterly nonsensical. There's such a disconnect, in my view, of how we think about life and what we're willing to apologize for God. That's a being that, to me, is not worthy of our adoration. He's more worthy of our contempt. I suppose there's an irony in all that, too, since October 15th happens to be the anniversary of Nietzsche's birthday, which is when the bombings occurred. Steve was an incredibly dear friend, and so was Mark Hoffman. I experienced enormous guilt for years. I was the person who introduced the two of them to each other. Idealistic, young, brash, incredibly naive young man in his mid-20s, thrown in the middle of all of this. There aren't words to communicate this. There aren't words to express the feelings of loss, regret. Since that time, I think that life has gone well. I went through a divorce shortly after the bombings, remarried, have a wonderful family, published a book in 1993 called New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, and was summarily excommunicated the following year for having edited the book. For me, that was a burden lifted, to be honest with you. They tried to excommunicate me before. I knew it would eventually happen again. I just felt like time to have this over with. But life goes on, and it continues to have its challenges. But for me, I'm at peace with where my beliefs have gone. I think I cherish life and I value it even more than I did as a believer. These are the only moments that we have on this great ship that we call Earth. We're all unwitting passengers on this great journey that we call life. And I'm thrilled, for whatever time my existence may be, to be a part of that. Thank you.
We have another person that was closely involved with Mark Hoffman, who's here in the audience. We'd like to have him come up and maybe share with us what he's done in the last 20 years. We have Shannon Flynn is walking up here. We'll have him share a few moments with us, then we'll open it up to some questions or comments.
Hoffman's still in jail?
Yeah, we'll get to that. You
better be.
Should I answer that question? Or?
You can answer it. We'll get into it.
Yes, he is still in jail. Will he ever get out? Who wants to know the answer to that one? I asked somebody that could know about that. I had an opportunity to talk to the guy who was head of the parole board probably 6 or 7 years, 8 years ago. And I asked him, I says, can I ask you about an inmate, you know, out there? And he said, says there's so many, come on. I said, I think you may know this one. So at any rate, so I asked him that question, and he said that it is his opinion that he will never come out. When he was up for review on parole, parole board at that time told him, don't ever come back for another review. Just camp yourself right there. So, unless something very, very bizarre happens, he won't get out. So he's a guest of the state of Utah for Tilly. The Gray Bar Hotel and Casino, I think they call it. Any rate, what's happened to me since then? I now live in Arizona, and I own two businesses there. I've been in the construction business for about the last 4.5 years, and a little closer. Ooh. And have a wife and 4 kids, and I am active in the LDS Church. I have been the entire time. This experience for me was faith-promoting, mind-expanding, intelligence-gathering experience for me, and I'm currently the executive secretary in my local ward. I have had the opportunity to talk to Mark a few times, about 7 or 8 years ago, something like that, 9 years ago. I went out several times, got on the visitors list, and went out and visited him. At least at that time, my impressions of who he is and what he is doing is he's a typical convict. He lives the prison life. He has learned how to just get along in prison, do what you have to do in prison to survive. He told me, and I'll tell you some of the things he told me, take this for what it's worth. He told me this, so may or may not be true. He actually gets along fairly well in prison because first of all, he committed 2 murders, which ranks him pretty high on the prison scale, and he also messed with the state's largest institution, the LDS Church, so that kind of puts him high on the pecking order. He doesn't really have a lot of problems with the other inmates, and at that time, he was in what you would call medium security. He was living in actually a situation where he's not in a cell. He was in kind of a barracks type thing. And then I had heard afterwards that he had been moved to minimum security. He's not a problem prisoner. He's not the kind of prisoner they have trouble with. He doesn't get in fights or, you know, stuff like that. He fully expects to just be there for the rest of his life. I don't know. He may harbor some secret idea that he'll be released someday, but not really. So and there's nothing really remarkable. For a period of time, he was the chess editor of the prison magazine and would probably rank as a master or grandmaster in chess if he, you know, was in that kind of a situation. He stopped doing that. Doesn't ever give interviews, doesn't ever talk to other prisoners about his life or whatever, and reads only a little of what's written about him. The 4 books, is it 4 or 5 books that's out? He may have read 1 or 2 and maybe glanced through some others, but really doesn't care. Seems to be somewhat disconnected from what happened.
Question over here. What was your connection with Mark?
Well, my connection was that I have had a long and abiding interest in the church and church history. And so started out in the collecting world. Well, in 1983, I think that was 1983, it wasn't long before you heard about Mark Hoffman. We had a friend in common, Lynn Jacobs, and it was through Lynn Jacobs that I was introduced to him. And became more involved in what he was doing and was essentially a business associate for probably a year before the bombings. Sure, go ahead.
Why hasn't he given interviews to the national media? If he wants a softball interview with Larry King, would give him a whole hour and he can say whatever he wants. If he wants to be intellectually challenged, Mike Wallace would give him a run for his money. Why has he ignored both of them and everybody else has tried to get in there talking?
My sense of it is that he is working on information from his attorney, Ron Yengich, and I'll just give you my speculations here. Ron Yengich also represented 2 fellows, Shelby and, I can't remember their names. Yes. They gave interviews after they were in prison. Those interviews were used against them as they approached their death sentences. So he gave Mark instructions to never say anything so that it could not be used. Now, that, of course, is working on something of a funny idea that he may have the opportunity to get out someday. But I think that's quite why he's done that. I don't know that it's really well reasoned and thought out, but I think that's basically the idea.
I've had the opportunity to talk with Jack Ford, who's the media representative for the the correction system for the city of Utah. And for a long time, Jack would say he would get three or four requests a month from media to go to interview Mark. And he would go down and same thing. Mark, would you like to talk to such and such reporter? He says, no. And it's not too long ago he received a request from a person who wrote a book on Hoffman, one of the authors, and went down again. And Mark says, no, I'm not interested. And then he got a letter from Ron Yange saying, don't ask anymore. He just will not talk to anybody. So when someone does ask, Jack Ford says, I don't even go ask. I said, Mark doesn't want to talk to anybody. And we saw that, of course, with an experience with John Krakauer, who wanted to interview Mark Hoffman, do a book. And Mark says, I don't talk to you, but here's Dan. He's right next to me here. Talk to him. And now we got the Krakauer book. So, you know, sometimes it works out. But
well, maybe I can just finish off here, and then we can turn it, if you want to turn it to questions, how much time you've got. But at any rate, Saul, what have I learned since then? Well, I've learned that by nature I'm an optimistic and happy person, and I try to stay optimistic and happy. I realize that things go badly sometimes. I feel a pain for the Sheets and Christensen family that they probably don't realize. My sister was murdered by her husband about 2 years after the bombings. Her husband did O.J. Simpson. He did an O.J. Simpson on her. There was a daughter in the home at the time, about 9 months, and my parents now take care of that daughter. So I understand fully what it means to have someone in your family murdered. I'm sorry? Oh, yes. her husband's name was Mark Hacking. And he is a relative. Go figure. So at any rate, I've also survived skin cancer. And I don't feel badly about my life or what's happened to me. Stuff happens. And I think what I take from that is it's not a matter of what happens to us, but what we do with what happens to us. Do I believe and trust everyone that comes to me? I do not. Do I look at people with a more skeptical eye than I used to? I do. And when I find that someone has done wrong, I believe they have done wrong, and I don't try to wash it or make it, it isn't so bad. It is bad, and it is what it is. And as Kurt said, he murdered two people. He did other things too, but he murdered two people. And unfortunately, he really did kill a third person. And Dory didn't talk about this much, but what he did to his father, he may as well have blown his father up too, because his father really never overcame it. And so he hurt a lot of people. And now he's in prison for the rest of his life. And we're all out, and we're not in prison for the rest of our life, and I hope we can be happy from it. Thank you.
I heard a report at one point that Mark Hoffman had attempted suicide and been in out on one arm for a long time, cut off the circulation, and that his right hand is paralyzed and he'll never be able to forge anything again, in or out of jail. So if that's true, there is some poetic justice in all this. I'd like to comment if that's true.
Oh, go ahead. You don't have to move, Dorley. Here we go.
Okay. There are actually two different times that he did that, and my assertion is if he really wanted to, he would have died. I think it was more of a manipulation. The first time, I actually got engaged to get married, and he did that, and it ended their engagement. So it worked. Whatever he wanted there worked for him. So, but he laid on his arm for all day, and he ended up losing some of the function in his arm.
We're down to the very end here. In fact, we're probably past time. If you have any more questions, you may want to come up and talk to the individuals up here. I want to thank them for being here and spending the time with us. For many of them, for many of these folks, it was very emotional, and it still is, and appreciate their time. I want to just leave one more idea with you. Years ago when we had this symposium that was sponsored by Ken Sanders, we had our discussions in the Broadway Theater, and as we came out of the theater where it announced Mark Hoffman Symposium, underneath was the name of a movie that was being shown there, and it said, Never Again. perhaps we must remember these things so we can never let these things happen again. Thank you for coming.